It's that time for the writers, and tonight's best-selling author is a prolific writer, a well-known journalist and columnist. He has a passion for telling Australian stories, our stories, of great men, great women, and the times through which they both endured and prevailed. He's no stranger to historical accounts, especially at times of war. I'm just going to do a smattering of his books because that's all. Otherwise, we'd just be doing a list of books tonight. Brake Morant, Burke and Wills, Monash's Masterpiece. I mentioned war stories, Tobruk, Kokoda, Gallipoli. And as a former Wallaby himself, you might think it was only a matter of time before Peter Fitzsimons wrote his latest, The Courageous Life of Weary Dunlop, surgeon, prisoner of war, life-saving leader and legend of the Thai-Burma Railway. But he did have to be coaxed a little to write this one. Peter Fitzsimons, welcome to Weekend Nightlife.
Byrne, thank you for having me. I'm having a lovely time, and Happy New Year to you
Happy New Year. Absolutely not. We're only two days in. We're one day beyond it. So absolutely, Happy New Year to you. I mentioned you had to be a little bit coaxed into this because your publisher had been at you for ages to write about Weary. So what got you hooked on his story?
It's interesting. I mean, Weary Dunlop, I guess, an obvious subject for me, given like war hero and contemporary and former Wallaby, etc. etc. So my publisher first came to me in 95. I think I signed my first contract to do Weary literally, you know, 30 years, well, maybe 20 years ago, whatever, turn of the century. And then I just started a couple of times, couldn't get into it. And then strangely, or it was the rugby that got me into it, because I looked at, when I started to go the rugby angle with Weary Dunlop, if you and I met a month or two ago, you'll recall my visage. Some would say face like a dropped pie, face like a twisted sand shoe. Happy, that's partly because I played, I don't know, four or five hundred games of rugby in my life. But I was 300 games in, 400 games in before somebody said that bastard's good enough to play for the Wallabies. And at that point, I had 120 stitches in my face. I'd played four years in France, 1 year in Italy, fairly violent rugby, particularly in the southern part of France. Weary Dunlop had played, was the 16th match of rugby he ever played. He didn't take it up till he was 27 years old, was for the Wallabies against the All Blacks at the SCG. Weary Dunlop was also a boxing blue from Melbourne University. The brawl broke out in the first 5 minutes. Weary did the housekeeping, cleaned them all up. And it's a staggering tale that this man was so physically strong, and he was at Ormond College in University of Melbourne, and he was rooming with a Queenslander who said, I think you'd go okay at rugby. And so he went down, played for the fourth 15 in the first match, third, seconds, first, combined Australian university side, and then, as I mentioned, straight into the Wallabies. And at the end of that match, the press was just stunned that this bloke had come from nowhere. Said, how did you get to be so strong? He said, well, growing up on the farm at Benalla in Victoria, Dad would make us hold a bag of wheat under each arm, 210 pounds each bag. And, that helped make me strong. And they said, well, that's extraordinary. He said, well, there's another bloke at home who can hold another one with his teeth. So he was probably gilding the lily. But it was fascinating to me that Weary Dunlop was the complete package, because he had enormous physical strength and great physical courage, intellectual prowess like they don't make him anymore. He was fairly poor growing up, and it was the family thought his elder brother would be the one to go to university, which he did. But it was one of the teachers at Benalla High said, look, Weary, Edward, your son, second son, Edward Dunlop, he is so smart, I'm begging you to keep his education going. So he got an apprenticeship in pharmacy, then he went to study medicine. Then in the mid-1930s, he applied for a scholarship to go to the most prestigious medical institution in the world to teach surgery, which was the Royal College of Surgeons in London. And he won the scholarship, so he was studying there when the war broke out, immediately joined the Australian Army, went to the Middle East to be to organise hospitals, and he was a very good administrator, but Weary's drive was always to be on the front lines. He said, I don't want to be promoted, so I'm removed from the men. So he was a rat of Tobruk right there as the shells were landing, helping to sew diggers back together, then went into Greece and was there for the fall of Greece, but truly came to fame on the Tyburma Railway when the Australians were brought back to Australia. Weary's ship was deviated to the Dutch East Indies on the way, was there for the fall of the Dutch East Indies, was in charge of a hospital in Bandung in the highlands of Sumatra. And the first legendary act he did was, there was a fellow in the hospital that he was running, a wounded Allied prisoner, an Englishman, Bill Griffiths, who was missing two eyes, two hands, and half a leg because the Japanese had obliged him to crawl through a minefield and a mine had blown up. And as the Japanese arrived, the Japanese captain barked orders for one of his soldiers, kill this man. Weary stood in front of the Japanese soldier with a bayonet and said, any bayonet that goes through this man will have to go through me first. This man will survive. And that man did survive. And it was through acts of courage like that that the other soldiers went, this guy is out of the box. This is our bloke. This is the man we want to follow.
Yeah, so and Weary, he wasn't even really meant to be the leader, was he? Because, as you said, he was running the hospital. And if you're talking about the ranks, that are very much part of army life, he shouldn't have been even in charge of the POWs, but a bit like he was that natural on the rugby field, he was this natural leader. I want to talk more about Weary, of course, but I mentioned Peter Fitzsimons, that we call this segment The Writers. We really could call it The Readers, because in order to write a book like this, there's just so much information you had to take in. There's something like, 1,400 footnotes in this book of yours. Now, I know you didn't read every other book. And of course, there's already been books about Weary. So when you take it on, what are you looking for in your story? Of course, there's going to be similarities. Of course, there's going to be stories told again. But what are you looking for to tell the story you wanted to tell?
Allow me to say how much I love that question, Bern, because I do. Because I do the stories in a different way. And when I first started writing books, I started at the Herald in 1986. The first big book I did was a biography of my Wallaby captain, Nick Farr-Jones, my best friend. So it was a very good place to start because I knew the story and I had been there for, quite a few of the seminal moments in Nick's life. I was there. Our names were read out within 10 seconds of each other for the 1984 Wallaby tour to Fiji. And so when I started out writing, I wanted to be everybody gather around the campfire. It was a dark and stormy night. As the years passed, my writing style evolved to, I don't want everybody around the campfire. I want you, Bern, and your listeners, my readers, to be in the moment. So I want, through heavy use of researchers, to drain every archive they can find, every contemporary account, every diary. Look for me for what I call FD, fine detail, and SSS, sights, sounds and smells. Look for the esoteric stuff that puts the reader absolutely in the moment. So what I want is for the reader to be feeling like this is a stupendous novel. This feels like I'm actually there. And yet, instead of what happens in a novel when you're reading Great Expectations, the finest work in the English language, as wonderful as it is, there is still a tiny voice which whispers to you, this didn't actually happen. This is a figment of Dickens' imagination. There was no Pip. There was no Estella. There was no wedding cake. There was no Miss Havisham. The whole story of Great Expectations never actually occurred. What I have strained to do, for better or worse, is to use the devices of fictions, the disciplines of fiction, apply them to nonfiction so that you're reading actual dialogue. So all bits of dialogue in my book on Weary Dunlop, I didn't make them up. They came from diaries, they came from letters, they came from contemporary accounts, men that were there that then wrote about them later in newspapers. You footnote them And so you get the fine detail so that as you're reading, what I want is, oh, my God, this actually happened. He actually did that. How do we know? Because there's 1,400 bloody footnotes and they'll point you, ideally, to original documentation.
Yeah, there's a lot of footnotes. Eventually, you just give up and just accept, okay, I know this comes from a source and I'll just take Peter Fitzsimons' word for it. You're listening to Peter Fitzsimons on Weekend Nightlife. My name's Bern Young. Peter's latest book is The Courageous Life of Weary Dunlop, an extraordinary true story of this heroic surgeon whose courage and leadership provided a lifeline, a real lifeline, for thousands of Australian prisoners of war during World War II. It's interesting, Peter, that you say this FDSSS, you know, fine detail, sights, sounds and smells, because you really do go into an almost relentless level of detail on the day-to-day brutality Yes. and deprivation. And indeed, it's hard at times to read. I remember having to put the book down a couple of times just to take a breath Yes. because it's, you know, the ulcers that are like halved raw tomatoes on the legs. Yep. You know, your description of death by cholera is just horrendous, you know.
Isn't the cholera stuff just stunning? You know, like where you, I knew nothing about cholera, but one of the things that I found, what I also want is the inspiration of Weary. So you'll recall, Bern, the wonderful story with Tom Uren, who became the famous Australian parliamentarian. And in his maiden speech, he said, everything I know about life, about politics, I learned from Weary Dunlop on the Tyburma Railway. We were on one side of the creek. The Brits were on the other side of the creek. On our side of the creek, Weary said, I want all officers will eat exactly the same as the soldiers. The stipend that the Japanese give us under the Japanese Geneva Convention, we'll collect up the money, we'll buy eggs and we'll buy ducks from nearby villages. We will keep the men alive. Tom Uren said, on the other side of the village, the Brits marched in, the officers did none of the work, got the best tents, best medical care, all of the food, and 600 marched in, 6 weeks later 50 marched out. And it was, the fascinating thing about that for me was that 42 years after the war was over, the Tom Uren with Weary Dunlop go back to the Tyburma Railway for the first time in over four decades. And as they're going up, the only way they can get up to Hellfire Pass is for each man to grip the shoulder of the young Labor Party apparatchik who's come with Tom Uren. His name was Anthony Albanese. And the fascinating thing about that is that I've talked to the Prime Minister about that, and he said, well, Tom Uren was the father I never had. Tom Uren has said that Anthony Albanese was the son he never had. And there's a direct line, therefore, between, in a way, the politics of Anthony Albanese and the diktats of the way Weary Dunlop thought Australians should comport themselves. That said, I think it's fair to say that not with a gun to his head would Weary Dunlop have ever voted Labor.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? So he has this sort of socialist approach to survival, yes. but that's not his politics when he gets back. We'll talk a bit about his life once he's, you know, once the war is over, but I just want to shine a light on a few things that are just outstanding in these true stories, not just of Weary, but of the men around him as well. You know, mateship is an obvious part of this story. And Peter, you and I have sort of talked about this before, because I do, as a woman, sometimes, and I've said this to you before, that mateship can be exclusive. You know, sometimes as women, we feel like you blokes are doing the mate thing. And yep. and I'm also one of, you know, seven girls in a family. I've come from a matriarchal family, you know.
Yeah.
So this whole kind of male, you know, mateship, sometimes I don't know where I stand with it. But having said that, you know, there are just some accounts of this bond in this book that it is, you know, if Weary's not the lifesaver, then mateship is. This bond is yes. unbelievable, isn't it?
Isn't it? And I love the line. I haven't quoted it in the book, but in my book on Tobruk, Chester Wilmot, the great ABC war correspondent, I used to be able to recite this off the cuff, but basically at Tobruk, the Australians took on Erwin Rommel and the Afrika Korps. the German army to that point in the war had never been stopped. Well, the Australians stopped them. And Chester Wilmot, this ABC correspondent, he wrote, the abiding force in Australian life is not orthodoxy, it's not classicism, it's not tradition. It is the thing that makes men stick together through flood, through famine, through drought. It's something that Henry Lawson called mateship. And he said this binding force in Australian life was able to overcome everything in Australia. And it was so strong that not even Hitler's Stukas, his Panzers, his shock troops could overcome it. And it was just stunning, the way he wrote it and the eloquence of it. And I know exactly what you say, that sometimes it seems exclusionary of women, and yet it really is a binding force in Australian life. And what happened on the Tyburma Railway, those blokes looking after each other, was absolutely inspirational.
What can we get, do you think, now from understanding that bonds, regardless of gender, for instance, regardless of war, you know, I even think now, you know, since you and I last met, you know, we've had this horrendous event,
Bondi,
you know, this terrible terrorist attack, you know, and people, you know, there is something about people coming together. There is something about a bond. Now, that's a bit different to the sort of bond that we're talking about here with mateship, because that's not necessarily mateship, but there's something there, isn't it? What do you?
Yeah, there really is.
What do you think?
I often think of Kim Beazley, my erstwhile biographical subject. He said once in the election campaign 2001, he said, we all came here in different boats, but we're in the same boat now. And that was certainly something with on the Tyburma Railway with Weary Dunlop. They had this thing of, we're all Australians, we've got to look after each other. And in Weary's case, there was such stunning selflessness that they, you know, he was the most important one there, helping to keep them all alive. At one point, they managed to get an ox. They slaughtered the ox, and there was a huge cut of beef. The butcher, Jack Prescott, bought this whole big steak to Weary Dunlop, and he said, "There you go, Captain, have that for dinner tonight." And Weary Dunlop said, "No, take it back, cut it up into small pieces, and put it in the communal stew." And you know, there were stories like that. That selflessness that Weary Dunlop had, to one in, all in, and we'll all look after each other. I think we can learn from that. The other thing was the staggering innovation of the Australians.
I know. I was actually just about to say, ingenuity is the other thing that just stands out, because isn't you it? Mentioned a butcher, but of course there's carpenters, for instance, amongst them as well, with these POWs, who, let's remember, are on the edge of death or life, whichever way you want to put it, at this time, and yet their brains are ticking over. Tell me about some of that ingenuity.
Well, the Australians, of course, were composed of butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, rich men, poor men, beggar men, thief. They were all there. They had all these skills, and Weary harnessed those skills to keep the men alive. And we mentioned cholera. One of the things, the most moving story in the book, I reckon, is when cholera hits, Weary notes that it's the older men that are better able to keep alive than the younger men. For some reason, those that have been around the block have this will to live that is greater than the younger ones who haven't yet fully lived. And the only way to keep the men with cholera alive, because what happened when you got cholera? Every orifice in your body was turned into an open tap to expel everything inside you. And the only way to keep them alive was to get saline solution into them. How are we going to get saline solution into somebody? Well, we need to get boiled water with salt. We need to put it through tubing. We need to put it into a cannula to get it into their veins. And the only way to do that was to harness the skills of the men. So they got a 44-gallon drum. They get a roaring fire so that they keep roaring. They get the tubes from an abandoned Japanese lorry to gather in the steam, to put it through vats of cold water in bamboo. The cannula was a sharpened bamboo shoot. It was all put together by a South Australian carpenter, a brilliant man. Bob Fox was his name. And, you know, so there are all those skills to get this done. And as they put it in, as they put it into these guys, there was one guy, he was a young fellow from Victoria. Well, the first one I loved was a guy called Scotty. He was a 42-year-old with three children from Melbourne, and they in the heights of cholera, There's 20 men that are dying, trying to keep them alive in this cholera gulch tent on the edge of the encampment. And every now and then, Weary would say, that one's going to die. And when they lifted Scotty to the table to, you know, ready so that when he dies, they can put him straight on the crematorium pit that's the roaring fires outside, Scotty says, I know what you're doing, you bastards. You're wasting your time. I'm going to live. And after 12 hours, they bring him back. Did it again 24 hours later. And again, I told you bastards last time, I'm going to live. And they bring him back. Meantime, this poor bloke, his name was Bob Campbell. He was 22 years old. And he'd got married in Melbourne. Within 3 hours of the marriage, he'd been on the troop ship heading to Singapore. When Singapore fell, he was taken prisoner. He found himself in Changi prison. Then he was on the Thai Burma Railway. Now he's got cholera. And Weary keeps putting the cannula, the sharpened bamboo shoot, into his veins to get the saline solution in. And this bloke keeps pulling it out. And finally, Weary, trying to keep this guy alive, roars at him, men have risked their lives to build this contraption for you. Other men are dying for want of the saline solution we're putting in your veins. If you keep pulling that out, you will not only die like a yellow rat, you'll deserve to die like a yellow rat. And Bob Campbell looks him straight in the eye and pulls it out and says, I want to be with my mother. And Weary says, all right, son, lie back. You'll be with her in an hour or two. And he dies. In the meantime, off in the distance, for the third time, Scotty can be heard to say, I told you bastards, I'm going to live. And he did live. And at the end of the war, that bloke was 4.5 stone, still alive. He was the only Australian soldier not sent back to Australia by ship. They put him straight into a plane. They got him back to Melbourne to the Heidelberg Repatriation Hospital. He slowly got his strength back. And I met his 86-year-old daughter in Melbourne, in Stawell, Stawell, that wonderful Victorian town. I met her a month ago. I told that story and she said, that's my father. And wow. I talked to her afterwards and said, you know, was he a good man? She said, he was a great man. And, you know, so those kind of stories, it's such an honour, a privilege, whatever, I don't know. They deserve to be remembered. They are extraordinary stories.
You know, that brings me to a point. I was actually just about to raise this. And you're listening on ABC Radio to Weekend Nightlife, by the way. My name's Bern Young. And Peter Fitzsimons, if you haven't worked it out, is my guest. His latest book is The Courageous Life of Weary Dunlop, which, of course, is this extraordinary true story of a surgeon, a prisoner of war, a leader and a legend of the Thai Burma Railway. I did wonder, and this segment is called The Writers, so in a way I want to get into that idea of, you know, your role as the author here, Peter. What kind of responsibility do you feel knowing that you're writing true stories and that there are descendants who will be, you know, reading it, for instance? Do you contact them and speak to them beforehand, or do you meet them at the book launch in Stawell? How does it work?
I reach out. I mean, Twitter has been a great thing for me, oddly enough, that I put out when I'm doing a book, I say, this is the book that I'm doing. And then, you know, I've got 140,000 followers. And so it goes wide. And then people say, you know, oh, well, if you're going to do this, you've got to talk to this person, you've got to talk to that person. When I did my book on Kokoda, I put it in the Herald that I'm doing a book on Kokoda, and one of my readers contacted me and said, if you're going to do this, you've got to talk to my father-in-law, Joe Dawson. He became the key character in the book. And so when you're talking these days on a Second World War book, I think there's about 6 that might be left. You know, we're getting close to our last World War II veteran. We buried the last Rat of Tobruk veteran. It was just this year that he died. And, yeah, you feel a duty to get it right and to not write like a hagiography necessarily, well, not a hagiography where everything's fine and nobody did anything wrong, because that's not real life. And one of my guiding principles, when I started at the Herald, there was a brilliant writer, sadly since deceased. Her name was Vanda Jamrozik. And early on in my time, Vanda did this piece on the front page of the Herald about two Polish immigrants to Australia, and they'd come with nothing. They'd built this shoemaking business, I think it was, with 200 employees, and it was just fantastic what they had accomplished and how much stronger they had made Australia. And right in the second last paragraph, and I'll never forget it, Vanda quoted one of the Polish immigrants saying, "And we only came to Australia because we knew there were no blacks here." And I went, "What? Oh, jeez. Oh, that's an appalling thing to say." And I went to Vanda and I said, "I loved your story you wrote. But I got to tell you, geez, I was shocked by that second last paragraph and that shocking racist thing that bloke said. Why did you put that in?" And she gave me the motif that I've used ever since. She said, "Because that's what he said. That's real life. That's what he said." And I've used it ever since. So that the North Star you steer by is, what happened? How did it happen? Is it true? And, you know, so there's some of, you mentioned some of the graphic detail of the barbarity that, you know, the Australians faced there. And there are some views that you shouldn't put in that level of barbarity. Well, the answer is that's what happened. You know, and there's one line about the Japanese, you'll remember. The Japanese, by and large, they were victims of shocking, you know, militarism in their own nation, like the Germans. They, you know, we're all good people, but sometimes shocking strains of ideology take over and destroy a culture. And Japan was in that at the time, and the Japanese soldiers had a level of brutality which, you know, is absolutely shocking. And nevertheless, there was one Japanese guard there. That one bloke said to another one, "Look, that bloke Stumpy, he's not such a bad bastard." And the other bloke said to him, "Yeah, that's true, not such a bad bastard. But I'll tell you what, given enough time and a blunt razor blade, I'd split him from arsehole to breakfast." That's what he said. The North Star is what actually happened, and that humans, by and large, we're a complex being. We've got nuances in our characters, some of which are contradictory. And so what I wanted in my book on Weary Dunlop was to capture the humanity of the man, the experience on the Thai-Burma Railway, all the good, all the bad. And one of the stories I use at the end of it, Weary Dunlop was no angel. You know, and when he got back to Australia.
I actually just wanted to bring that up because you talk about the complexity of people and, you know, he's not perfect, that's for sure. I'm not sure you wanted to be married to him necessarily if you wanted your partner to be faithful. You might not have wanted to work with him even as a surgeon because he certainly did things his own way, didn't he? And this is back absolutely. After the war and, you know, well, too bad. I'm still in surgery. I'm doing me. So do you think you would have liked him? What do you think?
I think I would have loved him. I think, you know, as a footballer, I looked at the way he played, the way he spoke. He was my kind of bloke. There's been times, like, I mean, when I did my book on Douglas Mawson, Sir Douglas Mawson, you know, I deeply admire that man and what he accomplished in Antarctica. Ultimately, however, he's not quite my kind of bloke. And when I did Kingston Smith, he's my kind of bloke. You know, I loved writing about him. Ned Kelly, I've always said if I could bring my former biographical subjects to life and put them around a dinner table. You know, Monash, I really liked Monash, admired him deeply. But I'd put Ned Kelly on my, if I had 3 hours with these people being alive, I'd put Ned Kelly on my right shoulder at the top of the table. And I reckon I'd spend 2 hours saying to Ned, "Glenn Rowan, mate, what were you thinking? This was madness." But with Weary Dunlop, he was very much my kind of bloke, but absolutely, as you say, not perfect. He married a very fine woman. He was not faithful to her. He was deeply troubled about, you know, he'd been away from her for 8 years because he'd gone to study in England for 3 years before the war and was deeply troubled by the infidelity he'd had leading into the war. And then when the war was over, and further infidelity, including an affair with Lady Mountbatten, and was deeply troubled before he went to marry her. He did marry her. It's fairly well documented that, you know, the fidelity did not take place. I asked his second son, John, terrific bloke living up in Cairns, What sort of a father was he? And he said, look, he wasn't a bad father, but really he wanted to make sure that mum and we, my brother and I, were okay, but we were not in his top six priorities. Basically his absolute priorities were his fellow POWs. He was an advocate with the governments for proper care for former POWs, particularly Thai Burma Railway. He was not the world's greatest father. I was very surprised. I had dinner in Melbourne 2 months ago with a fellow that had been at school with John. And when I played rugby, my father, every game of rugby I played in Australia, from the under 12As to the Wallabies, my father was there. I just knew Dad would be there, and he was. And I was very surprised talking to this bloke to say, well, yes, I played rugby with Weary Dunlop's son, but my father was there all the time, he said, but I never saw Weary Dunlop, which surprised me. But one of the things was Weary in his post-war life was so busy. He was always, off on various projects. And while he was the best man there ever was, with a scalpel in his hand on the Thai Burma Railway beneath a swinging lantern while the monsoonal rains pounded and there was not enough food, this was the man to give the scalpel to in a team, in a professional team environment, in a huge Melbourne hospital in the 1960s. He was not the guy. He was late. He wasn't concerned about the theatre being available for other surgery that had been booked in. At one point, a fellow surgeon roared at him, "You may be the Christ of the Thai Burma Railway, mate, but you're not the Christ of this hospital." There were those were sort of the nuances. One of the stories that John told me, he said, "Oh, Dad could get in a few scrapes." I said, "Well, what do you mean by that?" He said, "Oh, well, the rugby player never quite left him." And I said, "Well, what do you mean by that?" And he said, "Oh, I'll give you an example. When my brother and I were 12 and 14 years old, we pulled into a supermarket with Dad, and there was only one spot left. And just before Dad got to it, put his blinker on, a bloke in a red sports car with a blonde stole his spot. Dad wound down the window and said, "Oi, mate, that's my spot." And the bloke showed Dad the finger, gave him the middle digit. And I said to my brother, "This is not going to end well." Weary gets out of the car, remonstrates with the bloke. The bloke gave him the finger again, told him to ruck off, a version thereof. And John said Dad lined him up and basically a hip punch, straight to the bloke's, under the bloke's right ear. He slumps back in the seat. He's been knocked out. Weary leans over, takes the handbrake off, pushes the car back out into the traffic and takes his car park spot. And, I said, "Well, okay. How did he not get into trouble with the police?" He said, "He was Weary Dunlop."
He was Weary Dunlop. Melbourne. He's the former Australian of the Year. He's on the 50-cent coin if it's the 1990s. He's on the front cover of Women's Weekly magazine. He's got a This Is Your Life on Australian TV. He has statues, of course, in his honour. So there would be some who would say, well, surely Weary's never going to be forgotten. But I do feel that without books every now and again, to remind people of these astounding stories from our shared history, perhaps even the great Weary Dunlop could be forgotten. So thank you for writing about him. Peter Fitzsimons has been my guest here on The Writers on Weekend Nightlife on ABC Radio. The book is called The Courageous Life of Weary Dunlop, Surgeon, Prisoner of War, Life-Saving Leader and Legend of the Thai Burma Railway. Peter Fitzsimons, thank you.
Thanks so much, Bern.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.